Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Tonight, we're going to continue our study. We started back in May. We did a couple of lessons in May. And continue our study called Why Should I Believe? Which, at its core, is a study of apologetics. And we've been defining this every lesson, but a branch of theology devoted to the defense of the divine origin and authority of Christianity. Peter said it this way, you know, be prepared to give an answer for the hope that is within you. And we talked about that in lesson one, that it is a biblical mandate to be able to explain why you believe what you believe. And for many of us, as I said there in week one, belief has actually been pretty easy because we grew up with it. It's all we've ever known. But what happens when we're questioned, or what happens when our children are exposed to other ideas from the world? You know, how do we as parents explain our belief in a creator to our children, to our grandchildren? How do we explain that belief to other people that we encounter? People who may say, well, there's no need for God anymore. Science has explained away the need for God. And we talked about that in the first lesson, that there are many who believe that science has explained away the need for God. We looked at quotes about that from different experts. And, you know, my thought on that is that there are a lot of people who believe that science has explained away the need for God that don't really know a whole lot about science. Because, you know, for many of our children, our textbooks tell them that science can explain everything. It's a fact. All these things are fact. Like evolution is a fact. And that there's no question as to that's how things have come about. And so, anyway, this whole class, or this not class, but series, is designed to help thinking through how can we give an answer for our faith. And one of the things that we wanted to do in that was to talk about this idea, well, can science really explain everything? Has science really explained away the need for God? And that led us to the lesson that we started the last time, which is looking at holes in Darwin's theory of evolution. Okay, and I'm not going to go back and revisit everything we looked at in the first part of that, but in this, the entirety of this lesson that started last time, there's three major holes that I wanted to go over, and I've been over one of those. Okay, but I want to revisit kind of the high-level thinking about evolution, and then I want to revisit that first hole just briefly to a couple of things that I do not think I communicated very well, okay? And I want to kind of clarify some things, okay? But the idea here is, you know, thinking about with those who believe that science can explain away the need for God, or even our children that are exposed to textbooks that present evolution not as a theory, but as a fact, right? And question, for us to question, well, is it a fact? Is it something that can explain away the need for God? Is it something that is worthy of our faith, the faith of our life, to put the weight of our life on? Does that make sense? And so we talked about Charles Darwin, who came up with the theory of evolution. He wrote several books, but his most noteworthy book, On the Origin of the Species, was written in 1859, and is looked at it by many as the beginning of the theory of evolution. And we defined evolution this way. From the Oxford Language Dictionary, the process by which different kinds of living organisms are thought to have developed and diversified from earlier forms during the history of the earth. We talked about things like the belief in a primordial soup, this protein-filled liquid that was on the earth, and out of this crawled a single-cell organism, and from this single-cell organism, every different species that's here on Earth today evolved, okay? So from a single-cell organism crawling out of a protein-based liquid, there has evolved every living thing on Earth, okay? That's the theory of evolution. And we talked a little bit about, again, some of the holes. We're talking about the holes in that idea. And the first one of those holes that we looked at was the hole of life from non-life. Okay? The concept of life coming from non-life is called abiogenesis. We talked about abiogenesis. But Charles Darwin, in his book On the Origin of the Species, he presupposed abiogenesis. Evolution does not explain how life began, right? It's not a theory explaining how life begins, just how from life came other life and other life and other life. Does that make sense? And to this point, there is still no scientific explanation of how life can come from non-life. Now, we talked about there are those who have calculated the probability of all of this happening by chance, of a single cell organism happening by chance. Assuming that all the elements are there, what are the chances of that happening by random occurrence? Okay? And if you remember, I had up on the screen, there was a 1 in, and then I had a 1 followed by 126 zeros. Okay? I won't try to say what that number is. It's a big number. Okay? A 1 in, 1 with 126 zeros, chance of one protein molecule spontaneously forming by accident, by chance. Molecule. But yet it would take 300 to 500 molecules just to make the simplest single cell capable of being alive. And so the person that I read the quote from described that as a naturalistic miracle. So there is a theory that, hey, this is how this happened through this random chance. But what that's asking is, do you believe in that enough that random chance happened for the weight of your life to lie on that? Does that make sense? I mean, it's a choice, right? I mean, because science says, hey, there's a one in a whatever chance, you know, and we talked about the stuff you hear all the time when people talk about this. It's the same kind of chance as if a factory at Boeing blew up and out came a 777 fully assembled and ready to fly, right? It's that kind of level of chance, but there is, I mean, again, does that mean, you know, you're saying there's a chance? Yeah, there's a chance, right? Okay, but it's a really, really small chance, okay? There's a really small chance. So science can't definitively explain how life came from non-life, right? Other than saying, if everything everywhere aligned in perfect alignment in an impossible percentage chance, then you could have had this single cell that flowed out of this soup, okay? Does that make sense? And I mean, even Kate and I talked about it after the lesson last time. Kate was talking about all the experiments they've done and passing electricity through this, you know, different soups and all this trying to get, anyway, there continues to be experimentation trying to prove that this could happen, okay? But there was one thing that I said that after it was, the sermon was over, conversations I've had afterward, I realized that I needed to clarify something, okay? And that is, I talked about what is known of as the Big Bang. And the Big Bang is not necessarily related to life from non-life, but matter from nothing. The idea is that there was at some point this gigantic explosion in space, and from that came, you know, the planets and the, you know, the stars, the planets, the meteors, the whatever, they all came from this explosion, and the Earth had this soup on it which began life. You with me? And what the point I was trying to make was that if you're going to have a big explosion, there has to be something to explode, right? And just slapping the label Big Bang on it doesn't mean that you can explain how the stuff came that exploded. Okay? What I did not mean to imply is that there is not a beginning. Okay? Science actually indicates that the universe had a beginning point, and that the universe continues to expand and grow from a single point. Okay? Some will even take that label, the Big Bang, and Christians will take that and use that and say, well, God's the one that started the Big Bang. I don't do that. I don't say that. Because the Big Bang is so associated with those that think science has explained away God. But I did not mean to imply that that there is no evidence that everything had a single beginning. Does that make sense, the difference? I was just trying to say that slapping a big fancy label on the front of it doesn't explain how we get something from nothing. Science can still not explain how we got something from nothing. Okay? But scientific evidence does show that there was a beginning point in time. There was a beginning point, and everything continues to expand after that. And so I want to make sure that was clear. Okay? The other thing that I presented was I talked about kind of the viewpoint of those who put their faith in science. That's what it really is. It's faith, right? Who put their faith in science. And I talked about how many atheists are so desperate to not acknowledge that there could be a designer, a creator, that they'll even say, well, maybe it could have been an alien that came here and started life on this planet. We call that directed panspermia, right? Remember, I had the picture of the little alien on the meteorite flying through the air. And I had a slide up there that said this: the fact that evolutionists are perfectly happy to consider the prospect of the origin of our species as the result of some alien science fair project, but completely unwilling to consider a divine creator, reveals their objection is philosophical, not scientific. And from that, I have put this quote up there. The question, religion for atheists. With this, the fact is that evolutionists believe in evolution because they want to. It is their desire at all costs to explain the origin of everything without a creator. Evolutionism is thus intrinsically an atheistic religion. From Henry M. Morris, from the Institute for Creation Research. And then I followed this up with this quote from Harvard biologist Richard Lewontin. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated commitment to materialism. We are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Okay? And I threw all that out there to say that, again, this is like, you know, atheism, evolutionary belief is like a religion. Okay? But what I did not acknowledge is that we all come into every point of view that we have with a similar kind of thing. Okay? And I want to explain what I mean. You know, they start off with the idea that there is no God, right? And that informs everything in the way they look at it. We call that a worldview, right? Start with, there is no God, and work from there, right? And clearly, if you start with that viewpoint, and you come down to, I can choose this side or this side, you're going to choose the side that more closely aligns with what you, the way you view the world, right? Okay? Now, we can do the same thing, right? I mean, we can have the same thing because we come from the point of, I believe in God. And so I come at everything where I have a choice of left or right, and if right is more closely aligned with God and left is more closely aligned with the world, I'm going to choose the right side every time, right? So we have a worldview. And part of the challenge of anything, studying Scripture, right, especially, is kind of looking at something completely and totally objectively, right? Looking at it for what it really represents. And so I didn't want to put that up there that, hey, the atheists are the only ones that do this. No, we all do it. We all have a worldview, right? Our worldview is informed by everything. How we were raised, who our parents were, what community we live in. It informs everything, right? And so that wasn't to say, hey, they're guilty of something that we never do. No, we all have biases. We have world, you know, different views that inform the decisions that we make, okay? Part of this study is to say, well, is our position that we believe in God, does it hold water, right? That's part of why we're doing this stuff. And so I didn't want to just leave. I felt like after it was over, I was like, I always say I don't want to turn the opposing view into a straw man, and I think I did it tonight. I feel like I just said, you know, hey, how could anybody possibly do that? When I'm sure there are things about what I choose to do with my life or what I choose to believe in that come from my worldview and not from diligent study that I have done, if that makes sense. Everybody with me? Okay? All right. So I want to clarify that. So I want to move from there, though, to talking about the second hole. And I, you know, we'll go as far as we can tonight. Hopefully we'll get through at least hole number two, and then if we do that, we'll do hole number three next week, or if I happen to have a burst of speed, we'll do them both tonight. I'm not counting on that happening. But the second hole is kinds evolving into other kinds. So the first one was life from non-life, okay? That's a hard thing about evolution, because evolution doesn't attempt to explain how life comes from non-life. It assumes it happened. Charles Darwin assumed that there was a beginning life, right? Without explaining where that beginning life came from. But one of the key tenets of evolution is that from that initial life, everything, every living thing evolved. And so when we talk about every living thing evolved, we're talking about one kind of living organism eventually became what? Another kind of living organism. Okay, what's the most famous example that we've seen in our textbooks, or at least more recently anyway, maybe not those of you that are a little older than me, but the most prominent example of one kind evolving into another kind. I'm not saying that actually happened. I mean it's presented that this happened. Apes into man, right? That would be one kind into another kind. Am I saying that right, girls? Okay, yes, okay. They kind of looked at me like, Daddy's gone off the deep end. I thought that was pretty straightforward. So, the idea, though, if you start with a single-cell organism, that single-cell organism has to evolve into everything that we have today. There have to be major changes, right, that result in many, many different kinds of living things, right? But the problem with that is, that the fossil record doesn't support the idea that one kind evolved into another kind, right? The fossil record does not support that. And so that's what we want to talk about here in this kind of hole number two. Hole number two, kinds evolving into other kinds. And I've got in my notes, simply say the fossil record does not support the idea that one kind can evolve from another. Now, that's a pretty core tenet of evolution, right? One kind evolving from another kind. But the fossil record doesn't support that. Now, that was what I just read. So I forgot I had a slide on that. So we'll move on to the next one. Within the concept of evolution, there are different kinds of evolution, okay? And I want to make sure we're clear on this, because the type of evolution that is referred to by the theory of evolution from Charles Darwin is macroevolution, kinds from other kinds. And some will say species from other species. Okay, I'll tell you why I don't say it that way in just a minute, mostly because of Sarah. But kinds from other kinds. But there is a concept of evolution called microevolution that I believe in. I believe happens. Microevolution. And here is a definition of microevolution. Evolution on a small scale, over a short period of time, where small genetic changes enable an organism to adapt to its environment and or become a new subspecies. So microevolution is small changes that organisms develop over time to help them better live in their environment. Okay? But they don't change, but in microevolution, it doesn't change what they are, okay? A rat doesn't become an elephant, right? Still a rat. It just adapts to its environment, okay? So let's talk about some examples of microevolution, okay? Well, we'll come back to that. So here's a quote. Philip Johnson, who was an attorney, he wrote a book called Darwin on Trial. And this is one of the things that he says. He says, everyone agrees that microevolution occurs, including creationists. In other words, Christians. Okay? Even creation scientists concur, not because they have, quote, have tightened their act, but because their doctrine has always been that God created basic kinds or types which subsequently diversify. The most famous example of creationist microevolution involves the descendants of Adam and Eve, who have diversified from a common ancestral heir to create the diverse races of the human species. I left out a couple of letters there. All the diverse races of the human species. So we believe that, you know, ultimately all humans on earth descended from Adam and Eve. And from Adam and Eve, we have all the races of the earth, right? Does that sound agreeable? This means yes, this means no, right? And we don't all look exactly the same, right? We have differences. And we believe that those differences, you know, evolved, microevolution. We don't believe that those humans then became something else. They didn't turn into an airplane, right? I mean, they stay humans, right? But they different humans based on their environment look different, descending from Adam and Eve, right? Does that make sense? Okay. Now, let me give you another example of this, okay? One of the most famous things that Darwin is known for is his example of, or one of his kind of proofs of evolution, was when he was on the Galapagos Islands. He went from island to island to island, and he noticed that all these different finches, birds, on different islands had different shaped beaks. Okay? They all had different shaped beaks on different islands. But what were they all still? They're all still birds. They're all still finches, right? They have different shaped beaks. Now, one of the reasons why I don't use the word species, saying species evolving from other species, is because to a scientist, every one of these is a different species, okay? But what are they all still? They're all still finches. They're all still birds, right? And so while they're in their environment, they may have, you know, micro-evolved different beaks to deal with their environment, they're still birds, right? They're still birds, okay? We don't have any fossilized evidence that, you know, that one common example is that dinosaurs turned into birds, okay? We don't have that example. And so they have different beaks, but they're all still birds. We can even mess with this a little bit, right? We see this all the time when you have dog breeding, right? You take a Pekingese and you breed a Pekingese with a poodle, and what do you get? A peek-a-poo, right? A peek-a-poo, okay? That's kind of engineered microevolution, right? You come up with a whole new dog, right? But it's still a dog, right? Still a dog, okay? It didn't become a cat. It's still a dog. Thank goodness it didn't become a cat, right? Yeah, it's still a dog, okay? We have a cat. Wow, they are fussy. But it's still a dog, okay? It's a different breed of dog, but it's still a dog. It's not a different kind, okay? Does that make sense? That's microevolution. Okay, that's microevolution, all right? Macroevolution is not that. Macroevolution is evolution on a large scale, where, again, if you believe that this single-cell organism crawled out of this, you know, primordial prebiotic soup, and from that single-cell organism we have all life today, you have to believe that there were some big changes over the millions and billions of years, right? And you get into, you know, Darwin's belief in natural selection, that there were some species that evolved that didn't survive because they were weaker, and the ones that survived were the ones that lived and then eventually evolved into other species. And so that's macroevolution. So evolution on a large scale, above the species level, over a long period of time, that results in new species and or new body plans, okay? Or new body plans. Now, a great book about this, about the topic of atheism, evolution, is a book by Norman Geisler and Frank Turek called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, which is kind of getting at the point that all of this is, you know, it's faith. You know, those that say I believe the science has explained away the need for God, that's where they put their faith, right? He says, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. He says, Darwinists are masters at defining the term evolution broadly enough so that the evidence in one situation might be counted as evidence in another. Okay? What they're saying is that they define it broadly enough to say, hey, look, the finches have different beaks. Therefore, that proves Darwinian evolution. You with me? Microevolution saying, hey, that proves that men, you know, men came from apes, right? Or then the apes ultimately came from a single cell that crawled out of a bowl of soup, right? You with me? And you guys are staring at me like, you have lost it, Tim. I can't tell if I've lost you or not. But he says, so that evidence in one situation might be counted as evidence in another. Unfortunately for them, the public has begun to catch on to this tactic, thanks largely to the popular works of Berkeley Law professor Philip Johnson, who I just read from just a minute ago. Johnson first exposed this Darwinistic sleight of hand with his groundbreaking book, Darwin on Trial, which I just read from. That's where he points out that none of the proofs provide any persuasive reason for believing that natural selection can produce new species, new organs, or other major changes, or even minor changes that are permanent. See, there's no evidence in the fossil record that one kind can become another kind. But what they're saying is that evolutionists will say, well, look at the finches that Darwin discovered on the Galapagos Islands that had different beaks. That's evidence of evolution. Yeah, microevolution, adapting to your environment, not evidence that a bird is someday going to become an alligator, right? That's not evidence of that, okay? There's no evidence out there that eventually, over time, these birds are going to turn into an alligator, okay? But what you will see is the evolutionists will go, hey, this proves, the different finches and their different beaks proves that evolution takes place. Well, yeah, we believe in this kind of evolution, just like we believe that all the races of mankind came from Adam and Eve, right? And so, but we don't have any evidence to put our weight on that this kind of evolution is going to produce something completely different, like an alligator, okay? There's no evidence that you would ever put a Pekingese with a poodle and you'd get a duck, okay? It's just not, there's no evidence that that's going to happen, all right? So Charles Darwin himself said that this was a problem, okay? He said this was a problem. He says, why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Okay, let's talk about context. If, go back to my absurd example of these finches evolving into an alligator, I realize that no scientist would ever say that's the chain of events that took place. But let's just say it once, for argument's sake, okay? What would you expect to find? If that has happened over billions of years, what would you expect to happen? You would expect that there would be fossilized remains of an intermediate state between the birds and the alligator, right? Does that make sense? I mean, I am not an expert on this, but I go, if it's been billions of years, there has to be some evidence that there's an intermediate state between the two, right? There has to be some evidence that there's an intermediate state between the different kinds, okay? And Darwin said the same thing. Darwin said, why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assured does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this, perhaps, is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. But Darwin assumed, remember how he assumed that life came from non-life? Darwin assumed that the fossil record discovered in the future would find these things, would find these intermediate links, okay? But what hasn't happened? They haven't been found, okay? They still haven't been found. And so Jonathan Wells, a scientist, says his theory predicts a long history of gradual divergence from a common ancestor, with the differences slowly becoming bigger and bigger until you get the major differences we have now. Okay, does that make sense? Again, you start with a single cell and you end with, you know, humans and monkeys and alligators and dogs and ducks and trees and whatever. I mean, there had to have been gradual changes over the, you know, eons, right? He says the fossil evidence, even in his day, showed the opposite, the rapid appearance of phylum-level differences in what's called the Cambrian explosion. You notice the rapid appearance of these different kinds, right? Called the Cambrian explosion. Darwin believed that future fossil discoveries would vindicate his theory, but that hasn't happened. Actually, fossil discoveries over the last 150 years have turned his tree. Darwin drew his theory of evolution into a tree, showing how different kinds evolved from other kinds and created this tree. He says the fossil discoveries over the last 150 years have turned his tree upside down, by showing the Cambrian explosion was even more abrupt and extensive than scientists once thought. So what he's saying is the fossil record has actually shown that these kinds just all kind of went poof, they popped on the scene, right? There's not evidence that there's these intermediary links in between the different kinds. And Darwin himself said, hey, that's missing. That's a hole. And he assumed that someone was going to find that in the future. Hasn't happened, right? It hasn't happened. Hasn't happened. He says, this is Niles Eldridge, who is an atheist, biologist, paleontologist. He says, no wonder paleontologists shied away from evolution for so long. It never seems to happen. Assiduous collecting of cliff faces yields zigzags, minor oscillations, and the very occasional slight accumulation of change over millions of years at a rate too slow to account for all the prodigious change that has occurred in evolutionary history. When we do see the introduction of evolutionary novelty, it usually shows up with a bang and often with no firm evidence that the fossils did not evolve elsewhere. Evolution cannot forever be going on somewhere else. Yet that's how the fossil record has struck many a forlorn paleontologist looking to learn something about evolution. What's he saying? It's not the fossil record, so we continue to assume it's somewhere else that we don't have. We keep pushing the ball down the road, assuming it's happening somewhere else. And he's saying, eventually we've got to stop saying it's going to happen, it happened somewhere else that we haven't found yet. Okay? He says, hey, everything kind of came on the scene with a bang, right? Everything came on the scene with a bang. There's not evidence that again, you got this middle ground between a bird and an alligator. You have birds. You have alligators, right? You don't have what's in between. Does that make sense? Okay, David, makes sense? Yes, all right, good. Okay, so paleontologist Robert Carroll, what is missing are the many intermediate forms hypothesized by Darwin. They just don't exist. They don't exist. And again, what is this all about? What is this all about? This is all about me asking myself the question. Has science explained away the need for God? This is not about me becoming an expert in science. I probably stated some things tonight that, you know, Kate and Sarah, we get in the car and go, you know, you said that a little wrong. And I'm sure I did. But I know enough about it to know that there's way bigger holes than most would lead you to believe. And ultimately, if this is a matter of where am I going to put my faith, evolution, is to me, doesn't have enough going for it to say, this is what's worthy of my belief. This is what's worthy of my belief. Because I do not believe it can explain how life came from non-life. I do not believe it can explain how we have all the diversity of life that we have on this earth. I do not believe it can explain those things. That's in my quest for being able to answer my own faith, why I believe what I believe. I don't believe that in those two things, Darwin can explain them for me. I don't believe Darwin can explain how we have life from non-life. I don't believe Darwin can explain how we have the diversity of life that we have on this earth. Paul was one who said, hey, look to the world around you. Look to the creation for evidence of a creator, Romans chapter 1. The psalmist, Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. I do not believe that evolution can explain those things. That's the second hole. Lord willing, next week we will pick up on the third hole. Which I don't know if that'll take, you know, I'm not even going to say it. I was going to say it's not going to take up the whole time. Of course it is. Of course it's going to take up the whole time. And then we'll move on to something else. But if you guys have any questions or comments or if I said something wrong, please let me know. Because my intention is not to mislead. But to, as I said in lesson one, to provide a reason for why I believe what I believe and to help in being able to have those conversations with our children, with our grandchildren, with friends, with those that we come in contact with that may say things like, well, science has explained away the need for God. Well, you can ask them, well, how do you deal with the fact that something from nothing, the life from non-life, how does, not in a way to, again, not trying to win, not trying to win an argument, but help me understand how you come to grip with something from nothing, life from non-life. How do you explain that? Because where we're going to go with this is I have been in several classes on Christian evidences, apologetics, that almost approach it as, well, let's disprove evolution and that'll prove God. It doesn't work that way. Evolution, we talk about that because there's so many to say science has explained away the need for God. But that doesn't by itself point to God. So we're gonna spend a little time talking about some of the holes in science. But then we're going to shift to talking about, you know, the reasons why, if evolution can't explain why we're here, if evolution can't explain where we came from, if evolution is not worthy of our faith, why is belief in a God a viable alternative to that? Why does that make sense? And can we believe the Bible? You know, what are the reasons why we can put trust in what we call the Bible? And even getting into, and you may have been asked these questions before, some very difficult questions that if someone knows that I believe in God or you believe in God, they may say, well, how could a good God condemn people to hell? Or how could a good God allow people to suffer? We're going to look at some of those kinds of things. So we kind of see the path that we're taking. So we're going to start off with science to say, can science explain away the need for God? But as I said, and I'm gonna let you in on the end of the story. Sorry I ruined it for you. But I don't believe science can explain the things that I see. Paul said, hey, look at what's been created. I don't believe science can explain what I can see, the diversity of life, the beauty of the creation, how life is even here. I don't think science can explain that. And one of the reasons why I believe in a creator, a designer, a God, because I look and go, what I see around me can only be explained by some being of a power that can design and create that science cannot explain. And because I believe in that, I also choose to believe in everything about Him. Believe that He sent His Son to die for us. It's all about choosing what we believe. So if you're here tonight and you've never formalized that choice to believe in God by repenting, which is really making a commitment to yourself and to God, that I'm going to follow you instead of myself. And then making that commitment public by being baptized. If you've never done that, we encourage you to think about that tonight. If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while we sing our invitation song.